I'm very pleased to welcome back to Free View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome, Martin.
It's fantastic to be here, Michael, as always.
We've got a lot to talk about, what's going on internationally, what's happening nationally, what's happening locally. I think we can make it international. Some people would say it's national. The coronation of King Charles III. Tomorrow afternoon, people going to watch it on television, unless, of course, they're going to the Fremantle Dockers match at Optus Oval to hopefully see them beat Hawthorn. But, Martin, I'm wondering just how many people are going to accept the invitation to join the homage to the new king and say, I swear that I will pay true allegiance to your majesty and to your heirs and successors according to law, so help me God. What do you reckon the uptake will be in Australia?
Oh, probably not that high. I mean, we have some monarchists. Don't worry about that. There's certainly some of those here. I think you probably get swept up if you're actually at the ceremony. And I think that was kind of Albanese's point when technically we're a constitutional monarchy with the monarch as our head of state. And so as the prime minister and you're there, then you may have an obligation to behave differently. But I don't think I'll be turning the oath, and I'm not sure I'll be watching, but that's probably just me. I think it is actually a really significant event, though. It's a reminder of our constitution and our governance system, isn't it? Often we forget that our technically our head of state is the king of England and Wales, et cetera. And also the fact that our governor general is his representative, and it's a bit of a blast back to 1999 when we had a chance to change it and we chose to stick with the status quo.
That, no doubt, being a good observation to make. The fact is, of course, we're also debating a voice to Parliament at the moment in Australia, which rather emphasises perhaps that epochs come and go and Australians are living in a new one.
It is. And I think for those of us that do tune in, but it will be quite fascinating because it hasn't happened for 70 years. There's been kings and queens inaugurated in other countries, but obviously there's significance for our country and government here to this coronation. And I think that they're trying to do a mixture of old and new. So there's all the traditions and pomp and ceremony that are part of the British monarchy and have been for hundreds of years and probably well over 1,000 years if you go back to the Anglo-Saxon kings. And then there's the fact that we're in 2023 and they're trying to be modern, inclusive and diverse. So I think there's a bit of old and a bit of new in the ceremony.
Not only that, and the one thing that I do like about it all is that Australia is giving a rather remarkable gift to the newly crowned monarch. And it comes from Western Australia in a sense. And it's the Western Ground parrot gift, Martin.
Well, it's good to see WA has its own flavour at the ceremony. And, yeah, we are one third of the continent there, Michael, and the plant and animal diversity in Western Australia is very, very significant. You'll see on show, it will be interesting for those that tune in, you'll see on show bits and pieces and flavours across the whole Commonwealth, and these are very diverse number of countries with their own culture. So a lot of the Pacific Islands, countries throughout Africa, bits and pieces of Asia, obviously Australia, India, you know, quite a bit of diversity across that spectrum, which will be all on show at the coronation.
Well, the money is going to a good cause. The King no doubt agreed to that. Well, that's one part of the international sphere, but whilst all that glad handing is going on in London, Martin. The war in Ukraine goes on. We had the spectacle of a drone apparently exploding over the Kremlin. And in quite recent breaking news, a drone seems to have been exploded over Kyiv in recent hours. The latter apparently being a Ukrainian drone that lost course and they had to shoot it down. So very strange goings on. Who do you reckon was flying the one over Kremlin?
Well, of course, you know, we've addressed this before. Truth is the first casualty of war, and misinformation really thrives in a wartime context. And so there's the first question is, who do you believe? I listened to some experts on drones, and they seem very doubtful that you could fly a drone more than 600 kilometres across Russia from Ukraine to over the Kremlin without being noticed. But, you know, there's a number of people that would want to assassinate Putin if indeed that was a drone trying to assassinate Putin. That's a big question mark in and of itself. But if it was, Putin does have his critics. When you're an authoritarian government and you can't express yourself democratically, you know, there's every possibility that there's disaffected people in Russia as well that might be up to this. It's theoretically possible that someone from Ukraine snuck into Moscow, flew a drone, put it over there. I find it very far-fetched, though, the US is involved, just because if it came back to the US, the US, I don't think, really wants to escalate this to a direct confrontation with Russia. And if they ever got involved in an assassination attempt on Putin, I think that would be a major misstep. I don't think there's any appetite for that in Washington at all. So I'd probably say that's highly unlikely.
I thought at best it might be a little bit like the protester who recently stenciled the logo of Woodside on the police headquarters in Perth, a very symbolic sort of action by somebody. But do you think we'll ever know?
Probably not. Don't put it past some random citizen being arrested and confessing to it and then later saying that they were tortured or worse. I don't think we'll ever probably know.
Well, I'll leave that cynicism to just drift past me, Martin. let's turn to national issues. Everyone thought the Reserve Bank was going to, in sort of the economists' jargon, take a haircut and go for a little bit of a rest down at the beach, but they didn't. They came back and put up the rates again. Were you surprised?
Yeah. I was a little bit surprised, only because most of the commentary seemed to suggest that there would be a hold for the next little while, just to see the full impact of the previous rate rises. And when you have rate rises, there's an immediate impact, but there's an impact over 3 to 6 months. So we don't know the full impact of the current rate settings until probably the end of the year and how that's settling. I think that if you look at this, the RBA is probably spooked by the fact that they might have taken too long to raise rates in the past. The genie got out of the bottle with inflation, and so they're trying to get on top of it early and settle it down. And they think it's better to raise rates and then perhaps even ease them rather than not get on top of this. I don't know. I think that seems to be the thinking. And that Rob Lowe was suggesting that that things would be fairly settled after this, but he did say something similar after the last rate rise.
Well, it's a great sort of performance art. I love the way governors of the Reserve Bank deliver their lines. None of what he said, of course, impressed any of the state premiers had all been meeting, and they came out with fairly sort of vicious words to rebuff what was happening. And of course, it no doubt affects the whole cost of living for a whole lot of people, including the marginal, which has led to a great debate about whether there'll be a job seeker rise when it comes to the budget. What do you expect to find in the budget, Martin? And do you think job seeker will figure prominently? We're being told it's going to be a very narrow gap, a slight increase for some people who are more than 55.
Yeah, this has been one of the really interesting ones to watch, the job seeker discussion. I think if the government, there'll be plenty of people in the government that would like to raise the whole of job seeker permanently. And certainly backbenchers have been agitating for that. I think Jim Chalmers himself is nervous about its overarching impact on the budget going forward as an ongoing recurring cost. And so he's gone up in halfway. I don't think he's gone halfway. It might be 20% of the way. He's endorsed a modest increase for job seekers over 55 and over. In fact, it's even more modest than that because the rate that was already applied for 60 and over. So he slightly extended that to a slightly younger cohort. His rationale is that when you get a bit older, 55 or 60, and you're long-term unemployed, it's very hard to re-enter the market. And there's they probably need more security. But I think there's also a lot of arguments that young people are very financially insecure as well. And, there's not a lot of difference, perhaps. The other thing that we saw when JobSeeker got raised during COVID is that a whole range of other social challenges that were linked to financial stress were eased. And charities mentioned that quite a bit. People in the welfare area, the NGOs who pick up the slack when things get really messy, they reported less business, which is actually a good thing. So there's a lot of other, because you end up funding charities anyway to pick up a mess, don't you? There's actually a lot of tangible ancillary benefits to having a fairer job seeker rate. Probably the other thing to mention, Michael, is there's the broader discussion is what can the government do around cost of living and also what can it do for low-paid workers? The other thing I'd point out is the aged care workers who do have a pay rise, and I think that's been pretty welcomed across the sector while still recognising that we need to do more. It's still hard to retain workers in that industry, and they are so critical given caregiving is becoming more and more important with changing demographics. So I'd expect that, yeah, that's not the last of things, but I think that change, that modest change, has even been welcomed quite a lot.
Other budgetary items that you might expect? I guess we want to see some numbers starting to appear in relation to defence expenditure.
A lot of the defence expenditure has been pushed out. It's a long-term initiative. It's a bit apples and oranges in comparing defence with JobSeeker in this budget. But notwithstanding that there's enormous commitments in the medium to long term around defence, and there's also discussions around whether defence figures that have been produced so far are actually rubbery. And there's a big contingency built in around those defence commitments in recognition of blowout before we've even started. I think we talked about this last time, Michael. It's one of the things that's made me very uneasy is that the amount of blowouts that happen in defence and the lack of leverage that government has, because there's not a lot of providers and you make commitments to work with someone and then they find ways to check up the costs. And defence has been notorious for cost overruns for a long time now.
Well, one way the economists always like to solve Australia's economic woes was to bring more people into the country, bring in lots of immigrants, find them jobs, keep rates of pay in some areas down low and increase the revenue take when they all had to pay their taxes. But the new immigration rules don't seem to be designed to achieve all of those particular outcomes, Martin, or do they?
Look, I see some optimism in them, and I'll wait to see more detail. But there's two things that they're designed to do. Firstly, an increase in the immigration intake overall, which is actually desperately needed. So across COVID, we had immigration just slashed. Virtually no one came in. But we're bearing the fruits of that now with crushing skill shortages across the board. Because we're very, very lucky. We're a destination country with migration. And we've used migrants really strategically to help us with a whole range of skill sets. And that's been lacking. And we talked last week, I think it was, about the construction industry. I mean, that's a mess at the moment. We don't have the right people. I think that's needed. The second thing is there's an overhaul for the categories, and that's actually really welcome as well because that's where I'll wait to see more detail, but there's just so many categories of immigration, and immigration agents themselves find it hard. If you didn't have an agent, God help you in trying to get in. I think it just helps connected people and people who can pay a lot to pay someone to navigate that system helps them. And apart from immigration lawyers, it doesn't help anyone else. And there'd be a lot of really good immigrants that unless they can pay people a lot of money to help them, won't get in. So simplifying the immigration system would really help as well.
You hear the politicians on the on all sides, using expressions like this is all about a bigger Australia, or this is all about a smaller Australia. And it's said with a certain ideological invective. What are the tags meant to convey?
One of the biggest criticisms, and I get it, around big Australia, that means more immigrants and a faster growing population, is that we don't have the right services and facilities to help them out when they get here. And I think there's an argument there. But I think that rather, I'd flip that and say that's rather than not bringing people in, I think the compunction should be on us to plan for this well and provide those services and facilities. So it's really essential that we improve housing, for instance. I mean, that needs to happen anyway. But getting the right housing together, getting the right support services, migrants may often struggle in different cultural contexts. They've got a lot to offer, but they're a long way from family, etc. If we can get people in and actually provide the right services and facilities, I think that the big Australia is a really, you know, I don't think that's that scary. If you think about where people live, they mostly live in the city, and we probably need to accept at times some more density in certain areas to make this work. So there's challenges for all of us to make that work, but they're not impossible challenges.
Well, one part of Australia that might suddenly be a big immigration destination place will be Tasmania, Martin. They've just got the 19th AFL football license. They'll have their own team, a name to be given yet. Perhaps the Tasmanian Devils. Everyone will want to flock there. All the Tasmanians will want to go home, all the footballers. It'll become the place. Is there politics in that sort of sports decision, Martin?
Oh, there's politics and sport often mix. It's kind of interesting to hear people say, take the politics out of sport. I don't know that you can, and they're intricately linked. So the politics around this new stadium is really interesting because Albanese went down there and promised a lot of money for it at the same time that there's a major housing shortage, right? And this got a lot of people's goat. But I think that there's actually different constituencies for both arguments. If you want tourism, if you want the economy to take off, you need high-level sporting teams. That helps. And so in terms of economic development, that itself is probably a good thing. In terms of housing, absolutely, that's a desperate need and needs resolving in its own right. But I don't think it needs to be either an or, and there's probably a role for both. So the money that you spend on sporting stadiums can often be a political football. And we know, of course, Michael, that the federal government didn't do much for the stadium here in Western Australia. It was a state-funded project, but practically. And so, you know, I think you get a. I think it was it Martin McGowan who said, "I know where our GST dollars are going," something to that effect. So, yeah, like there's a lot of politics in funding sporting teams, and I think that the Tasmanian Premier Jeremy Rockliffe is trumpeting the fact that he's got the 19th AFL team after they've lobbied it for about 3 or 4 decades.
Martin, here's an interesting question to finish off on today, and this is the topic of people in politics being actually friendly, good friends with people on the other side of the aisle, not just your brother-in-law who might vote for the other side, who you get on with quite well, but actually a serving member. And in New South Wales, there's a wonderful example of it. The Premier, Chris Minns, the new Premier of New South Wales, has a close buddy, Ben Franklin, who was once a young Liberal. He's turned to the Nationals and looks like he's being offered the job as the upper house president. And I even read this morning New South Wales Nationals are so furious about it, they're threatening to refer him to ICAC for considering a lucrative promotion. There's the sort of the specific question of that proposal, but what about having friends on the other side of the aisle in politics? It's not unheard of. Some people possibly even sleep with the enemy.
You do have odd bedfellows. Just on that one in particular, I think there's a lot of politics in that itself, because the upper house is a hung parliament in New South Wales, and it, it probably mostly will be because it's elected using proportional voting. So it definitely strengthens the government's arm to have a president that's non-government MP, because they've got one more vote on the floor around legislation. So I can see why the Nats are not very happy about that idea, even if it's born out of a cross-the-aisle friendship. But you do get some really odd partnerships. Of course, we remember Troy Buswell and Adele Carles in Western Australia, which is one of the oddest partnerships I can ever recall. But I heard of one this week that must intrigue you. Monique Ryan, this trendy inner-city teal MP, is apparently good pals with Bob Katter, of all people. They both sit on the crossbench, but I think they're about as far apart in their probably personal experiences as you can imagine. And apparently they get along quite well. So I think that's really interesting. I would hope our MPs, even if they have profound political differences and their ideas, can get along at a personal level. And I think that's really, that should be something we aspire to in our democracy. You can have very different opinions with someone, but still have a respectful professional relationship.
Well, Matt, we'll watch what happens with the New South Wales example of how friendships can get you into a hot political water. But you have to be right. Being able to maintain proper dialogues in politics must be good for the legislative process occasionally. It shouldn't all have to be trench warfare.
Well, you do hope that occasionally those good relationships might engender some helpful, constructive legislation, motions, initiatives that see us progress in a number of areas. Whether it's sort of mental health or domestic violence or different things, there should be plenty of areas where parliamentarians of different political stripes agree on certain things and hope to progress things. So, you want your parliaments to be productive and to respond to the changing needs of a society. If they, we expect a fair bit of arguments, that's natural, but you want them to actually achieve things as well.
Martin, we'll save for another day the other interesting news overnight. Four Proud Boys have been convicted of seditious insurrection, a civil war offence in the US. It adds to the two or three Oath Keepers who were previously convicted for the things that happened just after Joe Biden's election. We'll come back to that and discuss the state of the American democracy and whether these legal developments actually suggest it's in reasonable nick, perhaps on our next view from the roundhouse. But in the meantime, lovely talking to you.
It's a pleasure as always, Michael. Always enjoy it.